Shortly before the sun came up on May 16, 1777, Button Gwinnett wasn't sure what the rest of the day had in store for him. All he did know, presumably, was that in just a short time, he'd be standing, guns drawn, in front of his longtime arch-rival, Lachlan McIntosh. The two men hated each other, and the entire colony of Georgia knew it. The origin story of their disdain for one another is rooted in, of course, politics. Their different views became competing interests, and the competing interests just turned into a genuine dislike that seemingly everyone in Georgia had to side with in one way or another. The feud had become a toxic mix of political shaming and military humiliation. McIntosh had stood on the floor of the Georgia legislature and in front of the state's political class had called Gwinnett a scoundrel and a lying rascal. As Gwinnett headed out to the site of the duel on the edge of Savannah, near what's now believed to be his burial site at Colonial Park Cemetery, he had to know what fate might be coming his way. Being called a rascal and a scoundrel could not, would not stand. His honor had been challenged. And so Gwinnett had challenged McIntosh to the duel. And in that era, this was the honorable and noble way to settle things. Standing a few paces apart, the two men fired their pistols. And the sound, no doubt, reverberated across Savannah. But politically, it echoed throughout the state. And within days, Button Gwinnett, the former governor and man who had lent his signature to America's founding document, was dead. Welcome to the Marked Podcast. Across Georgia, there's more than 2,000 historical markers that tell the story of a person, place, or an event from our state's past. And our digital video series explores a select few of those from Georgia's revolutionary history. And in this podcast, we're expanding on that with additional voices to help bring out the stories of these markers and the context of what they tell us about our state. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Marked, the podcast. I'm Andrew Iden, the executive producer of the Marked Project here at Georgia Public Broadcasting. And if you're a Georgia native, Gwinnett is, of course, a name you're probably familiar with. Gwinnett County is, of course, one of the largest counties in the state. And a man named Button, either now or in the Revolutionary period, was bound to get attention. And when you read his story and peel back the layers on a guy who, it appears, really wanted to make a name for himself, it's got a little bit of everything. There's some failure. There's plenty of that. There's also success in some ways. And then there's the stuff that sits between both of those, which is being kind of in the right place at the right time. So to unpack the story of Button Gwinnett, we're going to get a little help with two very esteemed guests today, men who are uniquely positioned to talk to us about Gwinnett from all those different perspectives. And our first guest is the Dr. Elaine B. Andrews, Distinguished Historian at the Georgia Historical Society. He is also the managing editor of Georgia Historical Quarterly. He is a speaker, a lecturer, an essayist, and has even hiked all of the Georgia section of the Appalachian Trail. Stan Deaton joining us from Savannah. Hello.
Hello, Andrew. Thank you.
Our second guest is a writer and the author of Button Gwinnett, Failed Merchant, Plantation Owner, Mountebank, Opportunist Politician, and Founding Father. Perhaps even more interesting is that he is quite literally in the family as an indirect descendant of Button Gwinnett. He literally wrote the book. Colin Gwinnett Sharp joining us all the way from England. Thanks for being here, Colin.
Delighted to be here, Andrew. Thank you.
Well, I mean, if you're going to get two people in a room to talk about Button Gwinnett, you'd be hard pressed to find a better cast than the two of you. Colin, I'm going to start with you. You know, as we did our research on Mr. Gwinnett, and as somebody who's been to Gwinnett County many, many a times and kind of known that name, it was interesting to read and to learn about Button from a number of different ways. But I want to start with sort of some of what I gathered in the researching of him. And that is, you know, this is a guy that is known for having his signature on the Declaration of Independence. But this is also a guy, when you read about him, as you lay out in your book too, there's some missteps here too with Button Gwinnett, is there not?
Yes, I think you're quite right. He wasn't lacking in ambition. He went to the Americas because I think he'd reached a point in his profession in England as a trader where he sailed pretty close to the mark with the authorities. He had at least one trading ship was impounded for payment of his debts. There are papers in the Library of Congress that when he first started trading with the Americas, it was fairly close to the line. He made a tight bargain, maybe to his advantage, not to other people's. When he got to Savannah, of course, he set up shop as a shopkeeper. But what he really wanted with his ambition was status. As a trader in England, he wouldn't have had the sort of status he craved. And he reckoned, obviously talking to people he knew in the Americas, that if he did well in the Americas, he would get status, and that would improve his social lot. Unfortunately, like many people, America then was a land of promise, and you could either make it or not, as the case may be.
I think what's interesting about Button Gwinnett is that in a long line of people in the United States who would follow him, is that he seems to have failed at everything he did, but it had never in any way impeded his ability to climb at least the political ladder of success. You mentioned the right place at the right time. I think that was a lot of it. The revolutionary period was a time of really unsettled politics, if you will. And I think he took advantage of that. I think he absolutely, as Colin said, he was ambitious. I think they all were in some way. This provided an opportunity for people who had never done very much to sort of step forward. He seems to spring out of nowhere. He gets elected to the Georgia Assembly from St. John's Parish, which is now Liberty County, south of Savannah. But he hadn't done very well at anything, but that was no impediment. I mean, it sounds familiar to us now, a failed businessman who somehow climbs the ladder and gets to the top, not to make this political in any way, but this goes back. He really, and Colin and I have talked about this many times, it goes back to this period and to the end. He really personifies the idea of a man on the make who doesn't let failure stand in his way. And other people didn't let it stand in his way either.
And yeah, I mean, speaking of that idea, Stan, not letting failure get in the way. I mean, that whole story actually starts in England. And I want to play a little bit from our video episode so people can understand more about the Button origin story.
If you're looking for someone with an interesting backstory, Button Gwinnett might be your guy. His last name actually comes from the Kingdom of Gwynedd in Northern Wales. Button is born in Gloucestershire, England in 1735, and in 1762, he is married with three daughters. Gwinnett runs a shipping business in England, and in 1765, he decides to go across the ocean to America. His first stop is Charleston.
But he doesn't stay long and soon heads south to Savannah.
Button comes to America first, and then he sends his family later.
Anne, and Anne brought to the marriage a dowry of £10,000, which was an awful lot of money in those days. And I suspect that Button probably needed that because it's pretty obvious his trading capabilities and history required quite a lot of money, and most of it was other people's. He was a trader, and I think that Button saw that by actually shifting his emphasis from England to the Americas, probably assisted by the fact that he was probably being sued and pursued by lots of people on this side of the pond, he saw that his future lay in the Americas. And in that respect, as Stan said previously, Button wasn't that much different from any other people that went across from England to the Americas. The difference with Button was that when he set up his store in Savannah, he was ambitious and wanted his status. When Bosanquet sold off the lease to St. Catherine's Island, Button raised £3,000 to buy it. Now, we know no idea how he raised that. I'm quite sure that unless the store was something like Macy's, he wouldn't have raised £3,000 off off the sale of that store. So he must have borrowed money to do that. In fact, he spent his whole life borrowing money, and he spent a lot of his life not paying it back. But the, you know, that shows how keen he was to get status, because once he got Sir Catherine's Island, he had status to become an elector. And if you became an elector, because you had to have 50 acres to your name to become an elector, if you became an elector, then he could gradually gain status and social mobility. He quite quickly became the, I think it's called the commissioner for Sunbury. So St. Catherine's Island is based on the end of the river up to Sunbury. So every ship going into Sunbury and coming out of Sunbury had to pay taxes. And guess who had to collect them? My suspicion is that there wasn't a great deal of audit trail in those days. I'm sure the good burghers of Sunbury were happy they got their taxes. They weren't too fussed about any taxes that might have been paid that didn't go into the coffers. And that all helped to pay off debts, loans, and everything else. And then there became Justice of the Peace, and then, as we'll probably discuss later, moved up the political ladder. But he grabbed any opportunity he could see with both hands. There's no doubt about that.
So the mercantile business does not work out, and Button Gwinnett wants to try something new. He decides he wants to run a plantation. So he buys a region of coastal land known as St. Catherine's Island.
Yes, he buys the entire island.
He bought it from, legally, Sarah Bosomworth, who was related to Thomas Bosomworth and Mary Musgrove, who were missionaries.
Gwinnett is extremely protective of this land, and he puts it out in the Georgia Gazette that anyone found fishing, hunting, or trespassing will be prosecuted.
Savannah was still, as I mentioned, new at that time. I think there was still plenty of opportunity for people like him who were not afraid, as he said, and most people weren't in 18th century America, to borrow money, were kind of shady about paying it back. Thomas Jefferson had a problem with that all of his life. I've always puzzled over how he managed to really not do too well as a trader and then still managed to buy St. Catherine's Island in its entirety, but he did. As he said, he borrowed that money from somewhere. What he had to put up for security, who knows? But I think that he chose Savannah and not Charleston, not Philadelphia, not New York, not Boston, more long-established places where I think it probably would have been more difficult, not impossible, but more difficult, I think, to break into established society already. Savannah offered opportunity for people like him. And he was, as we have noted, he's ambitious. He is not afraid to live on the edge, if you will, in terms of how to get ahead once he got here. And, you know, he wasn't a kid when he got here. He was 30 years old. Colin mentioned that he was probably fleeing creditors. That was not uncommon. And even when you got here, you usually, you know, it wasn't uncommon for people in Savannah to run somewhere else to get away from creditors. So, It's a fascinating story, and again, I think he's sort of in many ways he's sort of quintessentially the story of what this kind of place offered, if you will.
What do we know about his politics and sort of the way he saw the infancy of America and the way he looked at the business of government and governing?
As Colin mentioned, when you came to a place like this and you became a landowner, you had a stake in society. And so as soon as he did that, I think he was looked upon as somebody who would serve in the legislature, who would serve the people of his community. And I think that was part of his ambition and climbing that ladder. I think they were looked upon as the natural elite, especially in a frontier society. How he began to move along the road to revolution, I will leave to Colin. I'm just speaking sort of broadly and generally about people who were sort of at his level in colonial society. There was a natural sense of leadership and a natural sense of once you were successful, either as a businessman or as a planter, there were certain responsibilities that you were, I think, supposed to assume at that point. And by all indications, he did.
Colin, how about you? What are your thoughts on that? What did your research yield? And again, I know that, you know, we're kind of, the backdrop is that we're dealing with not a ton to be found, but what did your research yield about sort of his political leanings, thoughts, ideas?
I think he jumps on the political bandwagon. His background as a vicar's son would have been, I think, in a good Christian education, he would have been one for the people. You know, in the modern terms, he'd probably been a socialist. However, I think he saw at an early stage that as the move towards succession gathered apace, that that was the way he was going to make his political gains, and that was the way he was going to make his name. And that's what he tied his flag to. That's the mast he tied his flag to. He went, surprisingly, as an Englishman, he suddenly became a total political American, pushing for secession to cut the ties with England. And I think it was just political expediency. I'm not convinced that he had a political mantra which he wanted to follow. He saw where success was going to come, and that's what he followed.
Okay, quick lesson. Just in case you weren't paying attention in your history class, Revolutionary Georgia has two sides. The first are the Whigs, and they're the home team. Hooray! These are the guys who strongly oppose royal influence, and they've declared their loyalty to the original 13 colonies. And then there's the other side, the Tories. They've sworn their allegiance to the king, they're pro-monarchy, the royal cause.
And then, of course, there was everybody else. There was Governor James Reich trying to stave all of this off. He eventually, early in 1776, he has to flee to a British warship in the Savannah River. And at that point, the only thing I think that unifies the group of people known as the Whigs or the Patriots was the fact that they, were asserting their rights as British subjects, but also, and it's interesting to me that even though Georgia is seen as this frontier colony that kind of lagged behind, by early 1776, even though they're not represented in the Continental Congress, they are sending word there that they understand that this is a continental cause. This is not about regionalism. It's not about every colony for itself. And they made it known, whatever you all decide to do, we are with you. We will not resist. We will not stand in the way, as some colonies were already doing. New York, you know, just dragged its feet all the way through. And even when they it came time to pass, to vote on the Declaration and then sign it, they abstained. Georgia was not like that. Georgia had a lot to lose in this contest. There were a lot of people, of course, with the by then, of course, Florida was no longer Spanish. It had been British since 1763, but there's a huge native population on the frontier here pressing hard against settlement. And so there was a huge, it was a leap for them to make. And so once that leap is made, and this becomes clearly a military contest, and Colin will check me on this, but Gwinnett had military ambitions. We're talking about his ambition, and we're talking about the fact that he's an opportunist. So now the way to rise is through the military. And I think this is when we first see the conflict between McIntosh and Gwinnett. Who's going to lead Georgia's Continental Battalion, which is never going to be very successful and very big. So they're at loggerheads almost from the beginning. They both have military ambitions, and it goes from there. But I think that's the origin of it. I kind of wanted to just set the stage for where independence comes from and where Georgia was in that. Now, I'll let Colin talk about, flesh that out, if you will, the conflict between the two. Yeah.
And I think Stan's absolutely right. The issue was that while Lachlan McIntosh had a military background and was a professional soldier, Button Gwinnett had probably never fired a gun in his life. He had no military training as far as we know. And later on, when he became the governor, and you know, he became, quote, the commander-in-chief, unquote. But that really was of the militia. And as you were aware, the militia was, best described, a ragtag and bobtail selection of people on a fairly loose contract. No uniforms, different weapons. Lachlan McIntosh wasn't having anything of it. I mean, David Yusuf was defending the farms. They weren't useful for defending the state. But the feud with McIntosh is deeper than that, because Gwinnett managed to fall out, but not only with Lachlan McIntosh, but also his two brothers. The younger brother was sent down to the Florida border to try and sort out the royalist raiders down there, and it was a bit of a failure. It wasn't his fault it was a failure. It was because the Council of Safety provided no logistic support. Again, mostly troops and militia. they had no training of fighting in the fairly the heavy vegetation, the hot heat, bad logistics, disease, Native Americans, you name it. It was all thrown at them, and it was a failure. Well, Gwinnett blamed him for that, and that was unfair. And the other time he fell out with the other brother was when the brother was caught trading with the West Indies, and that was against the ruling of the Continental Congress. So Gwinnett was quite right when he picked up his jawed back to that was and threw him in the slammer, as we say in the UK, for Lachlan Mackintosh only to gather his friends and forces around him and get him out. But Gwinnett was right in doing that, because that was what it was. The trade was not allowed with England. As simple as that. So the feud goes further back. I mean, to antagonize Lachlan Mackintosh was one thing, but to antagonize his Sioux brothers as well was really the icing on the cake.
Yeah, you know, from what I have sort of read about this, you're underscoring what I had thought, which is it did seem like this was a scenario where Button probably had some inferiority complex, right? Because he did not have the military experience that Lachlan Mackintosh had. Lachlan had what Button wanted, and there was probably some jealousy or, you know, whatever it was. And that sort of, you know, was evident in some of the things that I think that are out there in terms of the research. And it's funny because, you know, these are, we talk all the time about some of the lessons of the past just always seem to come back in the current and in the present. And, you know, that's certainly one of them.
Mackintosh, you remember the name? But let's avoid confusion, because there are three Mackintosh brothers. There's Colonel William Mackintosh, who Button Gwinnett accuses of being a lousy leader. There's George Mackintosh, who opposes Button as governor, and because of that is accused of treason. And then there's Lachlan, who in 1777 is the Brigadier General of the Georgia Military Forces.
Lachlan was originally chosen for that position over Button Gwinnett, and Button, even though he's governor, is still a little bitter about it.
I would like to ask you both, you know, obviously the way that feud ended with the duel in Savannah, I'm trying to parse out what is real about what we know and what is sort of Georgia legend, as it were, in terms of what we know about that actual feud and how that duel unfolded.
Gwinnett challenged him to a duel because that's what gentlemen did. But Gwinnett wasn't a gentleman. And the other thing about duels at the time was they were matters of honor. Normally, the two would meet on the field at dawn with their pistols and their seconds and the doctor and everybody else, and they would walk their 10 paces each, turn and face, and normally fire a gun in the air, and all of us satisfied. That didn't happen in this case.
So Button challenges Mackintosh to a duel. A two guys, two guns, and one doesn't come out alive kind of duel. So on May 16th, 1777, just after he loses his second bid for governor, Gwinnett and Mackintosh meet at sunrise just outside of Savannah. Gwinnett and Mackintosh are facing each other with about 25 feet between them. They raise their pistols and they fire. Mackintosh takes a shot to the leg, and Button Gwinnett is injured, taking a shot just above the knee. And just 3 days later, on May 19th, 1777, Button Gwinnett dies of an infection, a pretty common occurrence in those days.
It's the fact that both hit the opposition means that they had no intention of trying to miss or show honor to be satisfied. That was a duel to try and knock out the other person. And I think actually it probably didn't mean much to Mackintosh, but I mean to Gwinnett, who apparently had no military training at all. If you fire a flintlock pistol, you put the thing on aim, and they are very heavy. You put it on aim, you aim down the barrel, you pull the trigger, and it seems in 1.5 and 2 seconds for the flintlock to go through, strike the keg, make the spark, for the gun to go bang. All the time you're holding that gun on aim, and when you're holding it on aim, you're looking down the barrel, and at the other end of the barrel, about 15 feet away, it's a double black hole through which a bullet's going to come your way pretty quickly. It must have taken quite a lot of guts to do that, That said, I just don't understand why. Well, I understand why Gwinnett challenged him to a duel, I think. I don't understand why he went through with it, because it's just a sheer, from my point of view, it's just sheer stupidity. And he was trying to make a point, which he had no hope of winning. And he didn't.
You know, it's... Stan, did you... Was there something you wanted
to add? No, that was a great description of what it must have been like. Absolutely.
Yeah. And to hear that description actually frames this in a way I've never really considered until today in this conversation, is that you could probably make the argument, and this isn't even really a question as much as it is just sort of a thought experiment for you two, is like his ambition and his sort of at any cost attitude, you could make the argument is what killed him in the end, no?
I think the other thing you had to consider is the fact that when he was elected the governor, it was only for a period of 3 months, and he wasn't re-elected at the end of that. And I think his political star had waned. People realized that he was all talk and not much action. I've spoken to people, you know, who say, well, no, he could have gone and been the president. Absolute rubbish. He would never have no hope of doing that at all. He didn't have the mental agility to be that. He was a populist politician that reached the top of his orbit and crashed to earth, basically.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. Even with the chaos of a revolution, I think that, you can speculate, had he lived, would he have become one of the statesmen of Georgia, in early Georgia? Would he have been elected to the Senate? I think Colin's absolutely right. I don't think so. I think he was, I wouldn't call him a flash in the pan, but he rose to the moment. It's what you said at the very beginning, right place, right time. The revolution provided opportunity for people like him. But I think that also it provided the opportunity for people to see through people like him and to see sort of what you were getting. I think he was rash. I think he was probably hot-headed. I think Colin's absolutely right. It was a death wish with no more experience than he had to challenge somebody like McIntosh to a duel. It did not play out the way the gentleman often played it out, as Colin said. Fired in the air, honor is satisfied, you walk away. And even if you don't make up, even if you don't paper over your political differences, you move on. And they didn't do that. I think he's right. They absolutely wanted to inflict bodily harm. They were each hit. And Gwinnett's wound proved fatal in probably what was an agonizing weekend. It's fascinating. And we've talked about this and speculated, you know, had he not signed the declaration, he probably would have faded into obscurity. I doubt where this all started. Was you talking about Gwinnett County? I doubt there would have been a Gwinnett County. There may have been. Georgia has more counties than anybody, and they need names to put on those counties. But his claim to fame has always been that in that moment, he was chosen to go to Philadelphia and sign that document. And by virtue of his early death, he deprived the world of a lot more of his own signatures. And so by virtue of economics, it became the rarest of all. But it is fascinating to play that sort of what if game, because we will never know.
We looked at what I would probably call his negative attributes, which is what he's known for, but he had positive attributes. And when he was Secretary of State, he started to write the Georgia Constitution, which by all accounts stayed in force until the Civil War. He increased the enfranchisement. So people who didn't have the vote before, he gave them the vote. So that, if you like, the middle classes and the artisans got the vote. They hadn't had it before. He broadened the political spectrum because he increased the number of parishes from 8 to 12. And that broke the hold of the great and the good and allowed more people to be involved in politics and probably to everybody's satisfaction and to the state's good. So he did have some positive moments, and I think we do see those when he was Secretary of State. But again, the background of that, of course, was all the other attributes that go with it. When he and Walton and Hall went to Philadelphia, they had a subsidiary requirement, which was to get money to support the defence of the southern border of the state. Now, surprisingly, they came away from Philadelphia with £60,000 for that, which is And there's no goodness knows how they did it, but they, you know, at that time, the colonists are fighting the British up and down the country, and then to give the southernmost state a purse full of money to keep out a few marauders. Although, of course, Florida was a royalist state, so it was there was, I suppose, a strategic view to that. He did achieve quite a lot. I don't know how much of that he achieved. Certainly, he said he achieved it, but it may have been done by the other two. We don't know.
Thanks so much for listening. And remember, you can catch up on all things Marked at our website at gpb.org/marked and on the GPB YouTube page. Marked the Podcast is written and hosted by me, Andrew Iden, and produced and edited by the GPB podcast team, Jeremy Powell, Miranda Hawkins, and Mark Davenport. And Sandy Malcolm is the Senior Vice President of Content.